Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Simon. I'm here with my trustiest of trusty comrades, Mr.
Thomas DeWill.
And welcome to Church History for Chumps. We are happy, so happy to have you with us today. And we actually have a third, you know, podcaster in the room today, Mr. Nick Davis.
Yeah, man, we've been stacking up the guests recently,
haven't we? We have. Yeah. And this is, you know, Nick's been pretty high on our list of guests since we really got started.
Yeah, Nick's been on our list from day one, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so...
Did we talk to you day one, or has it really taken us that long to extend the invite?
I think we just talked about him.
Mm. Well, I think the reality of all this is I'm high on the list because it's a very short list.
Oh, no.
So that's the part you didn't mention?
It's a long list.
It's a long list.
Yeah. I will say there's this handful of deceased people on the list. You know, should Charles Spurgeon or Walter Cronkite come back, they might knock you down a couple notches, but it's a long list.
That's fair.
Yeah. No, high on the list, and it's a long list.
Mm-hmm.
So Nick is a friend of ours that we got to know a few years back. He's here with us in Tucson.
Yep.
He's a family man. He's a native Arizonan, hailing originally from
Benson, Arizona.
Benson, right. Arizona. They call that the knee pad of Arizona. Am I right?
You might be right. It's never what we were told, but you know, we were kind of insulated from the rest of the state. So.
Oh, so you didn't hear what everyone was saying about
you. Benson's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
Look it up on Google Images and mm-hmm. you'll be delighted.
Won't take too long. It's pretty small.
Short look.
Yeah.
Don't blink.
But you also are a bivocational church planting deacon pastor guy.
Yep.
So you're officially a deacon in the Anglican Church in North America.
ACNA.
And you are and you're getting ready. You're in the process of planting King of Grace Anglican here in Tucson.
Right? That's right. Yep.
Yeah. Westminster grad. Mm-hmm. He's just a really I had a friend describe you recently as what was the precise wording? I think a profound Reformation Anglican. I thought that was cool.
Wow.
Who said that?
Zach.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I had a friend recently refer to him as a big jerk.
Yeah.
Well, referred to Nick as a big jerk?
It was also Zach.
What?
Yeah, no, that's not true. None of that is true.
No one's ever referred to Nick as a big jerk.
I can't think of it. Yeah.
No, we're glad to have you. You've got a voice and a face for radio. So
that's
you
right.
know.
Well, I like to say a face for radio, an ear for photography, and then eyes for music. Is what I like to say.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The so you're the package, really.
What they call a triple threat.
Triple threat.
Yeah.
Not threatening to many, but yes, definitely a triple threat.
So one of my favorite things about having guests on, and this is going to make Thomas and I sound really lazy, but it's that we can just kind of let them say, hey, talk about what you want to talk about. If it's cool, then we'll roll with it. And then Thomas and I kind of get a week off, and we don't have to really learn about
it.
And
it's way better than assigning you something to talk about, because you're the one who's the pro about whatever it is you're most excited to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And that's the thing. We're not looking for just like topics. We like the idea that there's something out there that excites you. And I think this guy gets you pumped.
I'd say he does. He gets me pretty jazzed.
All right.
Who are we talking about?
We're talking about John Williamson Nevin.
Wow.
I know.
Now, let me tell you,
don't blink.
I don't know who this is. So, I've got a complete blank slate right now. Yeah.
All right. Here we go. Well, John Williamson Nevin, since you asked, and since your people asked, is a former theologian, a Presbyterian Reformed theologian that comes from the 19th century. This would be kind of mid to late 19th century, and he comes from kind of the Lancaster area. And
Lancaster. All
that's right.
right. Cool.
Yeah. Speaking of Zach, there you go.
I was going to say, and August Burns Red, you know?
Whoa. Okay.
I'm sure
there's a lot of
is.
Metal that came out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania for some reason.
It's cloudy 8 months of the year, I hear.
So. Tortured, angsty youth out there.
Yeah. Definitely a lot of angst. So, John Williamson Nevin, let me just kind of, I guess, the best way to approach this is to maybe go to the end of the book first as to why he piqued my interest and why this study piqued my interest. And then we'll kind of go back to the beginning and kind of flesh out who he was, what he did, and what his contributions were and why I think people should know who he is.
Sure.
So, sweet.
Yeah, for me, Why did he first pique my interest? So, as you kind of mentioned with my background, I'm an Anglican. I am a transitional deacon, which means I am in the process of ordination to be a presbyter or a pastor or a priest, whatever term you prefer.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that season is being a deacon. And I, as you also mentioned, I am a Westminster, California graduate. And so you can see these kind of common themes coming together of, you know, a reformed training, reformational background, as well as, I guess, a liturgical sympathies or aesthetic. And so when I think about church ministry, you know, as preparing for this ministry, as preparing to, you know, plant a church here as well, you know, it's been a time that's required a lot of kind of self-reflecting of what am I about? Who am I? What do I believe the pastoral ministry is? What is church planting? How do you plant a church?
Mm.
What does that even mean? What is a church? You know, I think a lot of questions go into that that I was wrestling with through seminary, coming out of seminary, you know, working a full-time job as well in sales. You know, there's a lot of wrestling kind of with taking seriously how God builds his church, especially when you can't see it. You know, especially when you're in my situation where the notion of whatever this church is going to be feels more like a hope and kind of distant reality rather than a tangible reality you can name in the moment.
Hmm.
So for me, you know, John Williamson Nevin is known or kind of associated with a movement that we will get into, kind of viewed as one of the father figures of it, of Merseburg theology. And Merseburg refers to the name of the town that the seminary was in that he taught at.
Okay.
But we'll get more into that.
Yeah.
But him, along with renowned historian Philip Schaff, who both taught at the German Reformed Seminary there, are kind of considered the two figures about that. And there's a lot of reading that your audience can do about Merseburg theology. There's whole volumes on it that would be very good. But what Merseburg is kind of associated with for the theology nerds who want to get into it is kind of this way of being reformed that puts a high emphasis on the institutional church, a high emphasis on the sacraments, a high emphasis on participation in the church as central to salvation and being united with Christ. And so therefore it tends to be to emphasize, I won't say the corporate at the expense of the individualistic, but it does, I think, rightly emphasize that any kind of individual salvation and spirituality happens in the corporate realm of the church.
Okay.
And so that movement's kind of associated with some of those things. And so knowing that...
On its face, it's sounding good.
It sounds like a lot of fun, right?
Yeah.
Why not?
Sounds like maybe... Because what time period are we looking with right now? I know you told me you don't like dates.
I refer to you that I'm very poor with dates. So if any of your listeners send you spicy emails about my ability with dates, they were warned and they signed.
You know what?
A waiver,
there's other podcasts for the people that like dates.
Yeah.
Check it out. I mean, we'll have the dates, but this isn't, you know, isn't the right podcast.
Yeah.
So what date are we talking?
I got married to get out of dating. So
there we go. All right. Yeah.
Sorry. So we're talking about the 19th century. We'll get into here to two of his major works.
That's the 1800s, John.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Because do you still do that? Do you ever do that? Like 19th century
means
1900.
You have to do the conversion.
Oh, yeah.
It drives me crazy, but I get it.
I'm getting better at it.
I'm getting better too.
Yeah. There's also podcasts for people who are good at that. So
that's right.
So his two major works happen in 1843 and 1846. So kind of place that mid 19th century as the time frame where he's most active. I do know from my understanding, you know, this is again pre-Civil War, the pre-Civil War north of the U.S. The Civil War kind of has some effect, I think, on his life and ministry and what happens afterwards, but it's
What side of the Civil War was he on?
Well, he's definitely a northerner.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Because it sounded like you were like, don't ask what side he was on. I was like, that makes me want to ask.
Don't ask me to talk a lot about his interactions with the Civil War just because I don't know.
Yeah.
But
that sounds
now
really
your
interesting.
Listeners know that I don't know and it's fine.
But more importantly, our listeners also know that you're not defending a slave owner. So
no. Yeah, that would escalate things real quick. Thank you.
Yeah.
He was He was an abolitionist. I do know that.
Yeah. So there were some Southern Presbyterians who had really great theology.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer because it is wasted.
Definitely. Great biscuit recipes, great theology, poor practice.
Yeah, great.
It's hard to be good at all three. Biscuits, theology, practice.
And slave owning. They are great at that too.
Yeah, well.
Thomas looks so uncomfortable. All right, we'll move on.
We got some other podcasts we'll do.
That's right. There's more episodes for that. So with John Williamson Nevin, why does he appeal to me? I mean, the very title or the subtitle of this biography that I'm primarily working with is... well, I'll just say it. The primary book that I'm using for this today as a resource that I'd recommend to anyone who wants more information on him is entitled John Williamson Nevin, High Church Calvinist. It's by historian D.G. Hart or Daryl G. Hart. And so just that very subtitle, I think, gives you an idea of why he might appeal to someone like me. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were to put a label on who I am or what I kind of the way I tick, I would say I'm a Reformed High Churchman. In the sense of my theology and practice is reformed, and that includes a high view of the sacraments of the institutional church, but I wouldn't say I'm high church in the sense of how that can be misconstrued or how that's understood by some as being kind of more, would we say in Anglicanism, like an Anglo-Catholic? That's not where I necessarily come from, and that's not necessarily what scratches my itch.
Yeah.
But I would say having kind of a reformed high church mentality and way of thinking about pastoral ministry and the life of the church is very much how I tick. And so that's why he's appealing to me.
So a lot of people, when they think of high church, they immediately go to like the practice of what that church liturgy looks like. Like they think, this is a church where you can't walk in with shorts. You know, it's not quite as come as you are. It's a little bit, you know, you're more likely to see the pastor wearing some vestments, there might be some incense. Like, is that an accurate portrayal of what high church is?
I think that can be an accurate portrayal of what high church practice looks like on any given Sunday in America. Mm-hmm. That's a bigger conversation of what does it mean to practice high church worship and why do you practice those things? And I think, you know, different people come at that question different ways, you know. So some folks are really big on kind of the practice of habitus or the practice of a habit, and so because of that they want to really emphasize that the liturgy itself is kind of the main thing that happens in church, and it's the doing of liturgy, almost, you know, just by its doing that is powerful. And I think I would come at these things more from the angle of the liturgy, or what we would say just the structure of the worship service, is powerful because of what God is doing in the midst of it through the various words that are spoken. Mm. You know, God is, always working through his word, you know, whether that's his word in creation or his word in salvation, his word in kind of everyday providence, you know, in the life, the knowledge that we have, the knowledge we share with unbelievers, that's the word, you know, of providence and common grace. And in salvation, it's that word of the gospel. It's the word of the gospel both proclaimed as well as the visible words, as we call them, the sacraments. You know, so I'm more of the opinion, I think this is more of a reformational or reformed high church, or also kind of Lutheran as well, historical Lutheran sharing as well, that the power is in the word, and it's the doing of the word and what the word does to the hearer that makes it powerful. And that isn't just the sermon. You know, a sermon is not a different form of like a TED talk. It's in the whole thing. And the sermon and the sacraments are the high point. But from the very beginning of the service, when God addresses us in the call to worship, or in, you know, Anglican liturgy, we have the colic for purity where we're asking for the Spirit to come. Like, there are words that are happening that God is addressing his people with.
Yeah.
To the very end of the service where you end with a blessing. And that's not, you know, again, here's the real power of it. The blessing is not just well wishes by the minister. The blessing is God's very word that is blessing you as you go out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah. Okay. And so all that to say, so why this, that's kind of the background of what leads me into my interest with John Williamson Nevin. So kind of just getting into some biographical information with him.
Sure.
So he is born in February 1803, February 20th. In my notes, it says February 20th, 2803. So he was definitely before his time.
And after.
Yeah, and after indeed. So he's born, and like we said, kind of near that, I guess it's Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, up in that area that I'm unfamiliar with, you know.
Yeah, it's the capital.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. Mm-hmm. Nice.
They would have had a sports team there back in the day, probably.
Probably. Mm-hmm. Hopefully not the Phillies.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. But anyway, so he's kind of grown up, grows up in that area, grows in kind of, you know, almost a romantic setting, I think, for some of us, the way we think of, like, you know, early American theologians. He's the son of what this historian Daryl Hart called a, you know, kind of known, I guess, as a Latin farmer. That is, his father knew Latin and Greek and could have easily gone into the ministry, but didn't like public speaking. So instead, his father is a farmer and teaches his kids Latin and Greek while they're growing up on the farm. So he's the, I believe, oldest of the nine children of John Nevin and Mary, or Martha McCracken. And one of the things that I think is important from his childhood that the biographer notes is that the kind of early church that he grew up in, this Presbyterian church in the kind of home area that he's from, very much set a trajectory for what he understood the church to be and would kind of set out the course for his ministry in life, you know, which I think can be encouraging for anyone raising children, that that church setting can have a profound influence for where they go.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's kind of where he's headed. This is a very deep impression that's left on him. He, you know, and just to kind of give the 30,000 foot view from him of his biography, he, you know, he learns Latin and Greek from a very early age. He attends Union College in upstate New York at the age of 14, which, you know, even then we kind of, as moderns, think that everyone was going to college at like 12 or 14, but that was actually still unique at that time. He's kind of underwhelmed academically with Union College.
Any relation to Union Theological Seminary?
That's a good, I don't think so, because that's, Union's in New York City, isn't it?
I thought so.
I think so. This is an upstate, so I don't think they're united.
Okay, gotcha.
I think Union, I forget what Union meant at that time. I think Union at that time meant multiple denominations.
Okay.
I just think of it as like soccer teams, so English soccer teams that are not worth supporting. I digress.
I'm looking it up. I don't think they're related to the seminary.
Okay. I don't believe so. So he's the, so again, this is a time when, he's kind of underwhelmed by college. He also begins experiencing some health issues. Throughout his life, he would have, you know, digestive issues, and that would kind of lead to a sort of depression that would, kind of create this ebb and flow with Nevin, where there's times where he is just an absolute powerhouse. And I think, you know, this kind of, the physical ailments he experienced are part of why Nevin's not more well known. It's because there is times where this guy is just cranking. Like, he is writing stuff. He's writing articles for his denomination. He is teaching, you know. And then there's times where he really kind of just steps away and is, has, I think, a little more of a hermit life on the farm, you know. So
because he was going through seasons of physical...
Yeah, physical ailments, depression. You know, as we can get into later, there were also kind of his own internal doubts with his denominational affiliations. So we can get into that.
Sure.
Anyone who's, you know, wrestled with the notion of ordination seriously kind of goes through a little bit of denominational doubt as well.
But, so what was his denomination then that he was...
So he, well, let's, we'll get into that here in a second as far as his affiliation. So, but I just want to say, finishing with his time at Union, this is a significant time for him because this is when he has his first contact with revivalism. And this will be important because a lot of Nevin's kind of work has its sights set on revivalism and this kind of individualistic, revivalistic piety that is going through America at this time, you know, particularly associated with names like Finney and the like. And so he goes kind of, he is part, you know, I think it's funny, you know, like most people when they think of their college years and the experiences they had there, you know, they might think of it a house party gone wrong or something like that as being particularly problematic. Nevin's experience was being a part of a revival. So that's kind of what, that's kind of what traumatized him. But it's important. So he goes into this revival and he talks about, you know, experiencing this as being deeply problematic. And he talks about how this was problematic because it seemed to treat his whole upbringing in the faith, you know, this careful upbringing and nurturing that he experienced in his church and with his family, as if, you know, it was all for naught, and he was somehow not a Christian, you know. And he talked about it being, quoted, a subjective and introspective piety that only induced, I'm quoting here, induced more suffering rather than leading him to comfort in the gospel.
Hmm. Was it because these revivals were very, like, were they emphasizing repentance in an unhealthy way?
Well, part of what they, I mean, yes, I think you could say that, and how they would even, you know, what would they even define repentance as? But it was because it was emphasizing, like, you need to have a particular conversion experience. And then the people who are kind of running the revival are going to deem, you know, is this contrition or is this experience deep enough to consider you truly, you know, converted? Mm-hmm. And so,
for a little boy that grew up in a Presbyterian household that was baptized as an infant and didn't have a season of prolonged sin in his life, now he's at this conflict where he's like not having this conversion experience that he's supposed to have.
I think that's right. You know, like that's, or at least that's a part of it. Like, he, you know, he's formed in the faith. His parents carefully kind of raise him in the faith, you know, and then for him, there's always this assurance, like, you know, this is my faith. I'm a Christian. I know what I believe. And then that is kind of, you know, rocked, you know, in some sense. And so it's like his, the certainty of his faith becomes less so through going through a revival, you know. And I think he also is kind of noticing the kind of individualistic, and, you know, this word mechanical, I think, is important, you know, because as he takes aim at revivalism and kind of Finney's measures, as they are called, like, that's what he has in mind, is these kind of mechanical, programmatic ways of, you know, making supernatural things happen. You know, it's almost like a, you can cause the supernatural to happen by simply following the right, you know, recipe, if you will. So just keep that in mind, is like an important time. He goes on, you know, he graduates in 1821. He goes on to study at Princeton Theological Seminary. You know, in 1823, he studies there under some kind of well-known theologians that are familiar. And the primary one he studies under is Charles Hodge.
Okay.
Which is particularly important, you know, because anyone who kind of gets deep in the, you know, kind of theological weeds of Reformed theology is aware of Charles Hodge. They're aware of his role at Princeton Seminary. They're aware of kind of, you know, at least for me personally, you know, being aware of that lineage from Princeton Seminary as kind of this kind of old school Presbyterian of a way of being a Christian and theology that is then carried on to Westminster, Philadelphia in the early 20th century with J. Gresham Machen. That is then, you know, kind of Westminster, Philadelphia kind of becomes like the inheritor of that faith from Princeton Seminary, as Princeton Seminary kind of goes through, you know, modernistic trends. And then even for me personally, you know, Westminster, California being an originally an extension of Westminster, Philadelphia, you know. So at least for me personally, again, you know, I think this is part of my own personal sense of connection with Nevin, is, you know, he's part of that Princeton lineage, and in some ways I too am part of that Princeton lineage, you know, not like claiming anything great for myself, as, you know, I could enroll into Princeton today and, you know.
Right.
But you know what I mean? But, like, there's a theological and spiritual lineage.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And so this is important because, you know, it shows what Nevin's chops are. It shows that he, you know, is called to the ministry, or at least there's a sense of calling there that he's sensing and that other people are affirming as well, because that's what Princeton Seminary was for, was to train men for the pastoral Presbyterian ministry. He goes to Princeton. He does quite well. He actually does really well at Hebrew after a season of kind of, you know, floundering and struggling and doubting his own calling. You know, he's encouraged by another student, I believe it was, an older student, does well in Hebrew, and he actually takes over for Hodge for 2 years. And this is important because so Hodge goes on to study in Germany, and Nevin filled in teaching for Hodge from the years of 1826 to 1828. And this is a particularly important time because, first of all, it kind of, I think as we read back, it shows us what Nevin's theological chops were.
Yeah, he wasn't that old.
Yeah.
To be taken over at Princeton.
That's right, yeah. And he's, you know, he's filling in for this kind of stalwart of Princeton, right? This person who for 19th century Reformed Presbyterian, you know, churchman is, you know, one of the best. And so he's filling in for Hodge, and this is interesting because Hodge will later become an opponent of Nevin's. You know, I'm kind of reminded here of like Lion King with like Simba and Scar, you know, not saying that Hodge is Scar.
So Hodge was bad from the beginning.
Well, I don't want to say he's Scar per
se. Did Hodge kill Nevin's father?
I mean, I wouldn't go that far either. But if your listeners really want to get into dates, they'll definitely check me on Hodge killing Nevin's father.
Yeah, you heard it here first, folks.
He probably did actually hear it here first and hopefully last. So anyways, though, he goes in to fill in for Hodge for these 2 years he's teaching for him. And one of the things that I think Daryl Hart notes interestingly in the biography that would play itself out is he notes the irony here that Hodge is the one who's going off to Germany to study under, you know, the German theologians and philosophers of the 19th century.
Which are pretty progressive, right?
I mean...
Or are they moving in that direction, at least?
I mean, progressive...
Like Schleiermacher. It's like, yeah, the first person
like Schleiermacher, to yeah, like Ritschl, I believe, you know, those types of names come to mind.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to use the word progressive because of our modern conception of it. I would.
It's a different flavor of progressive for sure.
Yeah, different, you know, Fruit Loops versus Reese's Puffs, you know.
Yeah, that's drastically different.
Definitely. One's definitely better than the other. Mm-hmm. I'll say, like, yes, we can say progressive in the sense of kind of, you know,
out of the ordinary.
Out of the ordinary, new ideas, new philosophical ideas, but I don't want to use the word progressive as like antithetical to orthodox.
Right.
You know, though there certainly was some of that, you know, no
doubt.
They're
not like, oh, the Bible's not the word of God or anything like that. Something you consider a typical progressive theologian would say.
Yeah, sure. I think that's fair. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's examples to be found by your listeners that would maybe show otherwise that I want to hedge my bets upon. But I would just say for now, let's think of them as let's think of them in the positive sense of there's kind of new ways of thinking, particularly in German philosophy, that is being taught over there at that time that is not necessarily, you know, antithetical to Orthodox Christianity. And it's Hodge who's going off to study under those types of folks, but it's actually Nevin who never studies in Germany, who never leaves the continental U.S., but who actually, as Hart would argue, has a better understanding of their philosophy and theology. And it's that understanding of the philosophy and theology that actually kind of enables him to write some of the more profound and insightful things that he did.
So he's going to start shaking things up, basically.
Oh, he will. Yeah. He's going to do a lot of moving and shaking.
Okay.
Especially for Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of his early education. He then, you know, a significant thing happens in 1840. He joins the German Reformed Church from the Presbyterian Church at that time.
Okay.
And this is significant for kind of, as we're alluding to, you know, the German Reformed Church, as you two as Christian Reformed Church ministers may be aware of, is a very, like, ethnocentric denomination.
Sure.
So it's kind of centering in this kind of, you know, Pennsylvania Dutch, which actually refers to the, you know, the German population, not the Dutch in Pennsylvania, right? You know, so he's called to teach at their seminary in 1840, which is established at Marshall College in Mercerburg, Pennsylvania. So that's where the term Mercerburg comes from, is that city where the college is. That is set up there. I think it was moved there from Lancaster. Maybe wrong.
I'm sorry. I just was this find this interesting. So the German Reformed Church is what the RCUS is today.
That's right.
It's the same denomination. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, RCUS and then United. What is that? The United. It's a very much a mainline denomination. Forgetting it, but it's the United Churches of Christ or something like that.
UCC.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, they're super mainline.
Yeah. So I believe they also have a German Reformed lineage as well, but they're more so the kind that came out of Prussia that was trying to kind of merge Lutheranism and Reformed into one kind of general evangelical church. So,
okay.
But yes, the RCUSA is kind of the modern Orthodox equivalent of the German Reformed Church, which isn't much, not in the sense of not they're not good folks, but it's just a very small church and has a very small presence in the U.S. today.
Okay.
So So this is significant because it is this move in denominations that would really open up Nevin's ability to kind of get into the German mind, to kind of think that way and to really understand German philosophy. And it's going to open up his own way of conceiving of the church and conceiving of Christ's presence in the church. So it's really significant. There's two particular thinkers that influence Nevin. One is Frederick A. Rausch, and the other one is Johann W. A. Neander. And these two folks really kind of have a deep influence on Nevin and his way to conceive about the church. And so I don't want to necessarily get into too much of their exact thoughts per se, but one of the things that I think is important is Rausch's influence. And what was significant about Rausch's kind of philosophy is his understanding of the relationship of the actual, or what it was called, the actual and the ideal. And that is that there's kind of the basic reality of life, which is divinity. It is God. And yet what is kind of comes from that is everything that's in the sense experience, everything mm-hmm. that's kind of in creation. And so you get kind of this ideal life principle and invigorated with a kind of sustained phenomenological world that kind of happens out of it. And so where Nevin takes this is, as Hart would quote, say, Hart quotes here on page 77 of the book, "The ideal, that is Christ, inaugurated in the incarnation, became manifested in the real, that is the church and its ministry." Mm. So again, not to get too much into the weeds here or the philosophy of it, but for Nevin, you know, his ability to kind of think in these ways means that, you know, Christ is the ideal. Christ is the kind of truly divine, the reality. You know, that is who he is. He is, you know, both God and man, truly. And so that reality means that whatever the church is, you know, the church gets its significance because of its rootedness in the ideal, the divinity of Christ's life. And the church being, the church is also therefore the only expression of the true life of Christ in the world. Mm. You know, and I don't...
How would this have been interplaying with what's going on at the Second Great Awakening right now? Is it like, are these ideas kind of in contrast at all compared to like what Finney is?
Yes, definitely. So that, we'll get into that here. So the two main works that Nevin is known for that are particularly significant is, first, in 1843, he writes The Anxious Bench, A Tract for Our Times. Hmm. And this is a work in which he critiques what is referred to as the new measures of Finney. Hmm. And particularly what his critique centers around is, you know, he's going after Finney, but his real concern is how these ministers within his own denomination, ministers within these Reformed denominations in the area, within Lutheran denominations, these kind of historic Protestant denominations that would claim the Reformation as their heritage. And therefore, you know, because the Reformation is always about going back to the font, back to the sources, mm-hmm. Therefore the early church and the scriptures as well, he is concerned by how kind of, you know, how uncritically ministers in his own denomination are adopting some of these revivalistic Second Great Awakening new measures that are coming.
What would be a good example of a new measure?
Yeah. Well, the prominent one is right there in the title, this measure of doing using an anxious bench. And the anxious bench at the time was where, you know, you get someone who, you know, they were supposedly experiencing, you know, the conviction of the Holy Spirit in one of these revival meetings, you know, and interestingly, it's kind of like they would go to church every Sunday and, you know, a good Bible teaching church, and they would never experience this, but they're, you know, it's like, it's treating these revivals as this is where the real action is. You know, if you really want to experience, you know, real salvation, real kind of the Spirit moving, you need to go to a revival. That's where it's really at. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that would happen is you'd come under the conviction of the Spirit, you would go up to the anxious bench, you know, and it was there that, you know, you would be kind of counseled and experience for the first time true conversion. And you weren't truly converted, you weren't really a Christian, and you weren't really saved until you went through this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's kind of, it is the precursor to the modern day altar call, mm-hmm. if you will.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's kind of, those are some of the things that are kind of being adopted at that time. And I think, you know, so Nevin, he's really trying to critique those type of practices, and particularly they're being picked up in his circles of churches. Mm-hmm. So So it's kind of the first big thing he goes after with that is such practices. So I'll just, let me see. And here's a good quote from him too, to kind of get at what he's trying to contrast. So he says here, speaking of how does God really move? I think he's trying to really get at, you know, in contrast to the revivalistic expectations and tendencies, he's trying to argue for the nature of the church, how God really moves, how there's a very ordinary aspect of it, but that ordinariness is kind of the good news and the beauty of it. So here's what he says. It says, it is in the kingdom of grace, as in the kingdom of nature, the greatest, deepest, most comprehensive and lasting changes are affected constantly, not by special, sudden, vast explosions of power, but by processes that are gentle and silent, and so minute and common as hardly to attract the notice of the world. So you can see here that he's arguing for this way of being a Christian that is very different than the revivalistic measures.
Yeah.
And for him, these two are very antithetical to each other. There's the kind of revivalistic, the sudden kind of experiential, very introspective, you know, very kind of lacking assurance, you know, tracing everything back to a moment, tracing everything kind of, you know, away from the ministry of the established church or the institution of the church, to those type of kind of, you know, powerful, sudden moves. And for him, what he's arguing for is kind of the historic reformational or reformed and Lutheran too, way of being a Christian, which is, you know, you're baptized into the church as an infant. You are assumed to be a member of the church. You are raised in that faith. You're catechized. You're taught the faith. And that is always with the emphasis that you are eventually going to come to the Lord's table to receive the Lord's Supper.
Yeah.
You know, in confirmation or becoming a professing member. And so you can see that on one side, you have this very individualistic, very sudden, very kind of, you know, introspective, very subjective to the kind of more of the model of being nurtured and being raised and being formed and very kind of motherly speaking.
That makes me think of a C.S. Lewis quote that I encountered recently where he's talking about, like, what makes a good church service. And he says, I pulled it up, he says, a good shoe is a shoe you don't notice. Good reading becomes possible when you need not consciously think about eyes or light or print or spelling. The perfect church service would be one we were almost unaware of. Our attention would have been on God.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that as you were talking about, like, these practices that we have in church. They form us in a more profound way, but it takes a long time, right? It takes practice.
Yeah, it's interesting because I grew up in a church that did altar calls pretty regularly, pretty much every week. And I mean, geez, me being the anxious person that I was and doubting my salvation for the first, I don't know, 10 years of my faith, I responded to a lot of altar calls. I think I was always looking for the big explosive show of faith that God was going to be like, all right, now you've done what you were supposed to. Now I'm feeling it. And I mean, even when I left that church and went to a church that was a very, very different persuasion, I remember that was the church that I got baptized at. And when I was rehearsing, giving my testimony before the baptism, my pastor was like, yeah, that was good, but you didn't share when you got saved. Like, because in my telling, it was like, well, this is like the journey that I've been on that led me to faith. And he was like, no, you need a moment. Like, when did you become a Christian? When did you make that decision? And I was like, I guess it was this time. And I didn't know that you could think differently, because there were times when I'd be like, well, crap, I thought that I just kind of gradually came into the fold. Does that mean that I didn't come into the fold? And yeah, so I can, you know, trying to see it from multiple angles, I can see why the Second Great Awakening was so important, or was so effective. And I can see why revivalism was so effective, because it was, I'm sure in their minds, they were like, we're shaking people awake. Like, we are bringing people back to caring because people are just asleep in the pews and nothing is happening. So they're like, nah, we're going to get people excited. We're going to make a lot of noise. But the problem is they ended up kind of going so far that they, I don't know, kind
of threw a lot away. That Lewis quote finishes with something like, novelty prevents this. Right. Because novelty distracts us from actually worshiping, and we're focusing more on like the service itself. And
or I even think how you respond to the service, right? Like it's you're thinking about the emotions that are, because if you're thinking about how you respond to an altar call, you're not just thinking about God. You're thinking about, did I cry? Did I raise my hands in worship? Did I go to be prayed over? Like, you're really focused on judging the legitimacy of your response.
Right. And Nick, do you think it'd be fair? I'm not a great historian on the Second Great Awakening, but would you say it's fair to say that there was a lot of novelty being introduced into American Christianity at this time?
Yes, I would say that. Though what I think, you know, one of the things that we'll get into later in the impact of Nevin and how to kind of utilize him or to appreciate him is not draw such a sharp distinction between the First and Second Great Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think for Nevin in this churchly way of approaching Christianity, you know, it's easy, you know, I think especially as, you know, there's kind of a historical trend to think of, like, you know, First Great Awakening, Jonathan Edwards, you know, good. Second Great Awakening, you know, Charles Finney, bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Nevin kind of gets us to start to think as is at least to appreciate the hypothesis that both Jonathan Edwards and Finney are introducing something that's problematic and something that is novel as the way of being a Christian. And so... Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that the biography gets into is that, you know, Nevin is not just setting his sights on revivalism as itself. He's also setting his sights on kind of a New England Puritan form of Christianity.
Which would be more like the First Great Awakening, right?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. And I want to be very careful using the word Puritan, you know, because... Puritan, you know, we think we know what Puritans are and who they were, and we think it's, you know, that's very monolithic, like all the Puritans are the same, they all dress the same, which that part might be true, but they all believe the same, practice the same, and actually Puritan is kind of as broad a term as evangelical is today.
That's a good point.
What an evangelical is, you know, can be two very different things depending on who you're talking about, and so... I want it for your listeners. I want to use the term, you know, Puritan very carefully, but there is, you know, there is in Nevin's mind this kind of New England Calvinistic Puritanism that he finds to be also, you know, and that kind of has its center around people we think of like Jonathan Edwards. He also finds problematic. And the reason he finds it problematic is because it's, you know, for one, it struggles with the same kind of individualistic not anti-church as in against the church inherently, but kind of
like reduction,
reducing the church's significance. Mm-hmm. You know, the church is kind of more a voluntary association as far as like, well, we gather in the church cause we're commanded to, but it's not real where the real action is.
The church is almost the means to an end, right?
Yeah, that's right. Or the church is the after party, you know, you go to the church after the real action has happened, you know? And so for Nevin, there's reasons to criticize both. And that's why, you know, his critiques are not always well received by those who were in his same denomination or kind of in the same circles. Is for one, he was kind of calling people to account who he felt like were not being as careful with what their practice should be in regards to their adoption of new kind of revivalistic methods. But two, he's also, you know, he's not just, it'd be easy if he would just critique Finney. You know, that's why when people critique Joel Osteen today, it's just kind of, to me, it's a snooze fest. Because it's like, well, what are you saying that's really helpful? Like,
right, or new.
Right. Helpful or new. Or, you know, so Joel Osteen and his like, You know, first of all, I mean, if people are just jealous because he has nice teeth and nice hair, I get that.
But she does. He does.
100%.
Easy for you to say, Nick. All right, man.
Yeah, easy. That's right. You know, like, it's such, you know, that's an easy target. And it's not really a target, I guess. You know, there's a place for critiquing him, of course, you know, but at the same time, it's easy. Mm-hmm. You know, anyone can do it. What's really difficult and really requires kind of the soul searching is critiques to one's own fold, mm-hmm. and even more maturity, what critiques of one's own self,
yeah.
you know, obviously. And so I think, you know, it was kind of the same in Nevin's day. Like, anyone could kind of, you know, throw a grenade at Finney if you weren't a part of that, you know, kind of purely revivalistic ilk that Finney was in. But Nevin really has his sights set on, I think, the folks who are in his fold who are adopting these measures of Finney. And so, and you have to remember too, one of the reasons that Nevin's critiques do not always go over well is this: during this time, there's a strongly anti-Catholic sentiment in the U.S. And so anything that Nevin says that sounds too churchly is kind of understood as being...
You papist.
Yeah. Mm. He's a papist in Protestant clothing. Which I'm not sure what that dress would look like. You know, I would think
that's kind of a Puritan, you know, that's like their signature move, though, is to call people Catholics who just look Catholic.
Or witches,
yeah.
There's that.
Yeah, shout out to, yeah, never mind. We did a show on that already.
Yeah, shout out to Salem. You know,
and all of Europe.
True. So, so that's kind of the first part of his significant works, you know, is he's kind of critiquing that. And again, this is during a time in Nevin's life where he is, you know, absolutely crushing it as far as writing and being, you know, productive. I will say also just, you know, it's important, but it's not really what I want to focus on. Nevin would go on to be the president of Marshall College, which would later merge with Franklin College and become what is today Franklin and Marshall College. So he was always in an academic. He's always kind of a pastor in academic circles. One of the kind of, you know, important moments in his life that's worth mentioning, but not what I necessarily want to spend time on, is he does eventually go through a season of, you know, kind of longingly looking at the Roman Catholic Church, you know, kind of in light of his, what he sees as a very unchurchly Protestantism, a way of being Protestant that's so removed from kind of the churchliness of the reformers and what they thought the church was and the sacraments were and what preaching was, to this kind of, you know, revivalistic-ish Protestantism that Roman Catholicism begins to kind of appeal to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes through this season, and then it's kind of, you know, one of the moments that is kind of telling is that he preaches an ordination service in his denomination where he talks about what the ministry is. And that's a time, I think, that kind of shows what Nevin's true colors are. It shows why Nevin doesn't ultimately leave for Catholicism. It's because he is, deep down in his core, truly a Protestant. He wants to be part of the Protestant church. He values the Protestant church. But there's no question that he did not, you know, it's no question that he, there were times he looked longingly at the Roman Catholic Church because of the Protestant landscape. So, because he is... He's very much desiring this very churchly form of being Christian, you know. And some critics, I think, of Nevin would say that part of this reason is his kind of the romanticism that's in the air during this time, you know. And one could kind of read Nevin and say, is he innovative? Is he, you know, kind of bringing about new, greater, or deeper understandings of great truths? Or is he simply romantic? So I'll just put that out there. That is kind of a critique of him to keep in mind. And it's not even to say those critiques aren't wrong, but it's just to know, like, you know, that's as you wrestle with Nevin, you have to wrestle with that question as well. But I do think, however, I would fall on the side of being pro-Nevin and kind of thinking that, you know, rather than being a romantic, though that, you know, probably to some extent is true, I think what he's unearthing here is truly beautiful and significant.
Yeah.
It's striking me just kind of the power of biography and that I didn't know about this guy, but I mean, this is an example of someone from 200 years ago that is wrestling with what I think is a very common wrestling match for today. I mean, this is in our current kind of Protestant landscape, there seems to be a lot of movement, right? And for some, that's movement into the Roman Catholic Church. For some, that's movement into the Eastern Orthodox, or even towards Anglicanism. I wouldn't put those things right next to each other, right? But there's kind of a dissatisfaction with a lot of the like the novelty that's come in the last 200 years. So this is really interesting to see somebody kind of at the onset of kind of this season of American Christianity wrestling with questions that I think tons of people are wrestling with today. I think it's super relevant.
Well, and I think what's interesting too is, like, just like you said, Nick, like, he's not saying, let's go back to what the Puritans had right 100 years ago. He's actually saying, no, the Puritans were a little bit off too, and, you know, our homie Mr. Finney's a little bit more off, but really what we need to get back to are our Reformation ideals. And what I appreciate about what you're saying is, like, he recognizes that the value of what they need to get back to, this emphasis on the church, it's not a return to old ideas. It's actually a return to, like, the beginning of the tradition that we still claim, which is that we are Reformed, which is that we are Protestant, which is what our theological ancestors have been saying, which is emphasis on the church, on the sacraments and such. So yeah, that is really cool.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think kind of that's a good jumping point to his second major work, you know, which is it comes out in 1846, and it's entitled The Mystical Presence, A Vindication of the Reformed or Calvinistic Doctrine of the Holy Eucharist.
That's a great title, by the way.
That's right.
That's a great title.
Definitely. Yeah, channels, it's kind of, you can definitely tell it's from another time with the long subtitle there. But yeah, so again, you're right that he's hearkening back to this older way of being a Protestant that is unfamiliar even today. And I think, you know, we'll get more into his significance a little later on towards the end, but that is one of the things in which I think he's particularly helpful. You know, a lot of folks, you know, especially in the last 20 years, have moved into Reformed theology, and for them, it's out of a conviction of the biblical truth of Reformed theology. And mm-hmm. it's particularly for a lot of folks centers around their understanding of God's sovereignty in salvation, you know, an emphasis on grace and gospel centrality, which is all true and good. But I think if Nevin were alive today, one of the critiques he would have of kind of, you know, the young, restless, and reform movement and the like is that it's a very unchurchly movement. And I don't mean that in the sense that those folks don't, like, love the church. I think
I'd love to see a Nevin and J-Mac debate.
Yeah.
That would be huge.
That'd be entertaining.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, it would be a good debate. It'd be even better if it was a boxing match, maybe.
Yeah. You know?
Or at least like a thumb war, at the very least.
That might be all that we could get at this point.
That's right. You know, but, and, you know, I don't want to talk about such folks as if they don't love the church. I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But.
I would add to that.
Yeah, definitely. Like, those folks definitely love the church. Amen. In the sense of they love the institution of the church, you know, which is commendable. But what Nevin would say is that their unchurchliness is rooted in their lack of understanding of the sacramental nature of the church, the lack of the kind of understanding of the nourishing nature of the church. You know, this idea that, you know, one cannot have God as father without church as mother, you know, is very much an idea that's rooted, I believe, in Calvin said something to the like, and Nevin would, I think, definitely resonate with, you know, it's, you know, there's this, the unchurchliness in kind of modern, and this is actually Nevin's big point here that he gets into with the Lord's Supper, is that, you know, all well and good that kind of the modern reform movement embraces a high view of God's sovereignty and embraces God electing people.
Mm-hmm.
But what Nevin wants to show us is that God only does those things through his means that he's ordained for it. Like, yeah. God does not, sure, he ordains before all time, that's true, but how does that actually happen in time and space? How does that actually become a reality? And what Nevin wants to remind us of is that God actually does those things, the things, and again, go back to his distinction between the ideal and the actual. So God is actually working out those things that he knows from before all time, in time, in space, in the local ministry of word and sacrament. So it's not just that you are elect in this kind of a theoretical sense, but that God is actually electing you now. God is actually calling you right now by proclaiming the forgiveness of your sins. And I think, just as an aside, this is where Lutheran theology, I think, is particularly helpful.
Yeah, I was going to say, this almost sounds kind of Lutheran.
Well, I like to tell people that I'm practically Lutheran, which means...
Thomas likes to say that, too.
Yeah, which means that I'm almost, if it weren't for a couple points, I would be Lutheran. But I primarily mean that in the sense of, as far as practice goes, I think when you want to look to a denomination that has it right... Though they do have their own faults, of course, like anyone, the practical, how does like God actually work? Mm-hmm. Lutherans are particularly good because they have such a high view of the forgiveness of sins, of the absolution, of the proclaiming of the gospel, of the objectivity of Christ's body in the supper, not as a theological abstraction, but because they want to abstract, because they want to objectively say, this is Christ for you. Lutherans at their best are always emphasizing the for you, the pro me of the gospel that is not just for everyone around you, but this is actually for you, And so Nevin, I think, wants to hearken into that, though I do find it interesting his interactions with Lutherans is kind of mixed, but that's, you got to remember too, that's localized in his own setting in kind of this Pennsylvania Dutch Lutheran-ish.
We would all maybe be something else other than we are if we were in a different time and place.
Yeah.
It's just how it is.
That's right. And so, Nevin, in this work, The Mystical Presence, this is where he really starts to go kind of toe-to-toe with Charles Hodge because... Nevin is saying things about the Lord's Supper, and what Nevin's trying to emphasize in the Lord's Supper is that Christ is truly present in the communion service, like in the Holy Supper, in an objective way. Mm-hmm. And at that time, basically the whole of American Reformed theology has more of what we would kind of identify as a Zwinglian view of the Lord's Supper, that it is it's purely remembrance. Mm-hmm. There is no objectivity. Christ is not present. And Nevin is arguing against that. And what the real intriguing thing, and this is where it gets really interesting, if anyone wants to claim that they're a fan of Calvin, is Nevin in his work is actually riffing on Calvin's work. And that's why he says the Calvinistic doctrine. He's not using Calvinistic in the way we use it. Right. Anyone who likes thinking about God's sovereignty.
Grace.
Yeah.
He's thinking about it like Calvinistic as in old homeboy himself's doctrine of the Lord's Supper. Mm. He is riffing off of Calvin's view of Lord's Supper. And it's interesting because in his arguments about the objectivity of the Lord's Supper from Calvin, utilizing some of this German philosophy that he's receiving, Charles Hodge and others like Hodge are actually saying, well, Calvin got it wrong there. Calvin didn't actually understand the supper. Calvin had kind of these, I think they would even say like kind of holdover Catholic understandings.
That's the number one insult of anything the Reformers believed that you disagree with, is that it's just residual Catholic dogma.
Yeah. That's right. So Nevin, is trying to argue, and this, I think, if I recall right, this also plays into a little bit of his depression, because he's arguing for something that he so powerfully sees in the tradition, and the whole of his kind of modern experience of kind of the Reformed world, if you will, doesn't understand how this goes back. So here's kind of what Nevin's arguing for, just to kind of give a quote. So here we go. I believe this is a direct quote from Nevin. He says, "The body of Christ is in heaven, the believer on earth. But the power of the Holy Spirit, nevertheless, the obstacle of such vast local distance is overcome, so that in the sacramental act, while the outward symbols are received in an outward way, the very body and blood of Christ are at the same time inwardly and supernaturally communicated to the worthy receiver for the real nourishment of spiritual life." You see, so what Nevin is arguing is that there is an objectivity to the Lord's Supper, that, as Calvin argued, that in some way mysteriously, though it is always, the bread and the wine remain truly bread and wine, they are at the same time, mysteriously by the Holy Spirit, truly Christ's body and blood. And what Nevin is arguing is simply the reformational truth that, we do not have union with Christ in an abstract way, but we only have union with Christ through these objective means of grace, through objective preaching of the gospel, through the objective receiving of the sacraments. That is God's way of uniting us to Christ and continuing to build us up in our union with Him. You know, and Hart here has this interesting list here where, though all these people are critiquing Nevin, all these contemporaries are critiquing him, you know, Nevin, and he has this good, Hart has this good point that, you know, Nevin is not, at the same time, he's not just filling up this work, you know, with all these quotes from John Calvin, you know, as if to just kind of, you know, dump Calvin on someone and say, well, this is why you're wrong. Mm-hmm. But he says here, he starts his survey with Calvin, and then he goes on to others like Theodore Beza, Peter Marler, the First Confession of Basel, the Gaelic Confession, the Old Scotch Confession, the Belgic Confession, the Second Helvetic Confession, the Heidelberg Catechism, Zacharias Ursinus, the Synod of Dort, the Westminster Standards, all the way down to John Owen. You know, and that's the thing, you know, contemporaries can look on this and be like, well, Nevin clearly won the historical argument here. You know, because he is not just quoting Calvin, which I think is helpful too for any listener who would not kind of claim themselves as Reformed or a Calvinist, is that historic Reformed theology never treats Calvin as kind of this, you know, kind of, they never treat him as if it was like Jesus, Paul, Augustine, Calvin, you know. Calvin is always one significant figure among, you know, a plethora of reformers, you know, mm-hmm. and luminaries within the tradition. Absolutely. One of my professors in seminary, John Fesco, who's now at Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi, taught my Reformed Confessions class on the Westminster Standards, and he actually wrote a book on the history and theology of the Westminster Standards. And one of the helpful things in there is he studied the notes of the Westminster Assembly. And in the Westminster Assembly, you know, a person coming today and thinking, like, what are these, you know, Presbyterians talking about? And who are they quoting? They think, well, they're going to quote probably some stuff out of Ephesians and Romans, and then they're just going to have a ton of quotes from Calvin, and that's mm-hmm. where they get all their ideas. But if you look at the minutes from the Westminster Assembly, Calvin's named a fair amount, but his name and his kind of reference is only one of many mm-hmm. sources, mm-hmm. only one of many theologians, one of many historical figures, you know, that included church fathers, included obviously scripture, but it included people from the early church, from the middle church, you know, all the way up to that time. So, mm-hmm. so this is an important thing because these arguments brought a lot of heat upon Nevin. It brought a lot of critiques from contemporaries upon what they deemed the Merseberg theology. It was always, you know, under their critique of, again, being Roman Catholicism light. But he believes he's arguing for this older Reformation way of being a Protestant.
Yeah.
Do you think this guy would have been an Anglican if there was like some good Anglicanism near him?
So interestingly, two of his sons, I believe, or at least one of them, went on to be Episcopal ministers. You know, and Hart talks about kind of early on how Nevin is part of this movement, you know, for kind of this, the high church movement. It's no surprise, and this might be his romanticism, Nevin's romanticism showing, but it's no surprise this is happening around the similar time as the Oxford movement in England, with kind of the Anglo, which starts kind of the Anglo-Catholic movement mm-hmm. within Anglicanism. You know, so one, again, critically looking at Nevin may fairly or not fairly say that he's kind of just too much drinking from the same fount. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, you know, I think there is a beautiful way to conceive of being Reformed here that does not stray from any kind of being Protestant, but actually goes into the real rich historic mode of being a Protestant. And I think that's what Nevin offers us.
Yeah, I'm so excited to find out about this guy because I'm sensing, for one, I'm understanding profoundly why you like this guy. But yeah. But I'm really excited to dive in and learn some more as well because I'm realizing that there's others in history, not like I've conceived of myself as being like, you know, this lone wolf or anything, but I think that there's people in the Reformed camp who long for and want to push for a deeper and a richer understanding of the sacraments, but can't really move in other directions for other reasons, whether it's, you know, differences in ecclesiology or some other theological compromises you'd have to make to move in a different denomination or different way of practice. So this is really encouraging to see someone who's pretty closely aligned with where I'm at, you know, camp-wise, who's thought deeply about these things.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the beauties of Nevin and kind of this understanding of the sacraments that he's portraying here is, you know, I personally in Anglicanism, I see a lot of folks who want a strong emphasis of the sacraments. They want a very sacrament-centered way of being a Christian. And I think they go the wrong direction with it. So they'll either go towards like more of a Roman understanding of the sacraments. But for me, my real concern is they go towards a kind of works-based understanding of the sacraments. They, you know, they start to think of, you know, the Lord's Supper more in Eucharistic terms of, well, maybe it's not a sacrifice of Christ's actual body, but it's all about our Eucharistic praise and thanksgiving, you know? And so for me, and I think for, you know, kind of reformational Christian who, you know, as part of the, one of the unsaid but important distinctions that underlies all of this is the distinction between law and gospel, or in Reformed terms, the distinction between a covenant of works and a covenant of grace. And so with that undergirding it, I think it's important that when one goes down the sacramental trail, when one embraces that as the way of being a Christian, they must do it rightly. And the answer for that is to not go away from being a Protestant, but I think it's to go deeper into it. It's to go into a deeper reality of what is historic Protestantism. You know, and I think in our modern time, what does that look like? Does that look like being Anglican? Well, I think in a certain way, it can look like being Anglican. I think in a certain way, it can look like being a part of, say, like the CRC or the PCA or other denominations. I think ultimately, you know, one is going to be left wanting with any modern denomination, as Nevin was in his own day with the German Reformed Church. But for me, what's comforting is that Nevin found a space for himself in the German Reformed Church in which he could speak words that I think truly blessed the universal church, the church Catholic. You know, I think, you know, as folks who, you know, are in ministry and pursuing church planning, that's one of the lessons is that, you know, it's not that Nevin stumbled upon the perfect denomination, but Nevin found a denominational home in which he could say something that would bless the universal church and his local church. You know, and so I think through that, that's a lesson for all of us, right? Is that our particular voice that we speak does that same thing.
Yeah.
And so kind of like, you know, I know we're kind of getting close on time here. So kind of, you know, coming around to what is Nevin's impact? Why do I think he's significant? You know, we kind of started at the outset of why, what drew me to him, you know, and we've gone through kind of what are some of his major ideas. But what is his big contribution? What is the real takeaway from Nevin? And I think it's this, that Nevin has this understanding of what the church is, why the church is significant, and what, how it is that God moves in the world. But also we talked about the first and second great awakening. And what Nevin also, I think, teaches us is that, you know, when folks, and Hart particularly gets into this in the later, you know, kind of parts of his biography, so I'd commend that to anyone who wants to know more, because I think that, you know, I'm riffing off Hart's work here and want to give him credit for it, but I think this is one of the things I've thought about is we often think of, you know, any kind of cultural ills or dangers that are out there. We think it's easy for us to conceive of, you know, modern history as this happened because of the Enlightenment, you know, or this happened because of, you know, the sciences, you know, but what Nevin would argue, I think, and what Hart is trying to argue for is this kind of, you know, this moving away from the church, or people kind of, you know, I guess you could say the onset of secularization, for lack of a better term, because I don't think, you know, I know Hart nor myself consider secularization inherently all bad, but that's another podcast for another time. You know, but this kind of what we consider of a time of de-churching, of mass de-churching in America that happens around the beginning of the 20th century and has continued on today. You know, a lot of people think, oh, that's because, you know, kids finally got to read real science books, you know, or, you know, a number of other things, or, you know, there were just a bunch of sin out there that got them, you know, and, you know, differing views of sexuality. And that's what really kind of is the demise of Christianity in America. But what I think what Nevin's trying to argue for is that the demise of Christianity is a demise in as much as one de-emphasizes the work of the church. Mm-hmm. One de-emphasizes the sacramental life of the church. And that happened not just in the Second Great Awakening, but actually goes back to the First Great Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of Nevin's insight, is that he's for him, the critical moment is not just the time of Finney, but he's going back to, when did the breach happen? When did the split happen from this kind of churchly way of being a Reformed Christian?
Mm.
So I think here's a helpful way to think of it. So of what the church's significance is, and here's a question he wants to ask, is what is the church's role in the life of the Christian? Is the church, you know, a political organization, or is the church simply a charitable organization? You know, is the church a kind of social organization? And for Nevin, the real meaning, you know, or even kind of in a, you know, maybe one doesn't think the church is any of that, but they kind of think, well, we need to gather simply because we're called to, and I don't really know why. You know, that's kind of the view I feel like I got when I was in college, you know, and I'm in campus ministries where a lot of good is happening, and it's kind of like, well, I know the action's happening out there in your dorm Bible study stuff, but you really, you know, you need to go to church, and it's kind of like, well, why? And it's like, well, you know, Hebrews 10 or something, like we need to gather together and stuff like that. But for Nevin, I think what he's showing us is that the real action of the church, the real significance of the church and why it matters, is because that's the only institution in the world where God has promised to give his grace.
Mm.
And furthermore, that is the place in the world where this grace is not, you know, this grace is not just good news in the sense that it's comforting, though it is. But this grace is something that is a deep, divine, eternal reality that comes from God, from the very triune life of God, that comes from before all time, God's choosing of his people. But that does not happen in a theoretical way, nor does it happen kind of in our bedroom when we're having this intimate moment by us and just us and Jesus. But this intimate kind of reaching from God into our very lives happens only, or not only, but primarily and centrally in the life of the church.
Mm. Yeah.
And that if the gospel from before all time that reaches out and chooses you and chooses me has to happen in the very moment every Sunday when the minister says, for Jesus' sake, your sins are forgiven.
Mm. Yeah.
And when you receive the supper, and you also see, as the Heidelberg Catechism says, as just as my, you know, teeth press against the body and my lips touch the wine, so surely can I be assured that my sins are forgiven.
Mm.
That is what the church does. That's the beauty of the church. And that's how God builds his church. And I think that's what Nevin wants to teach us.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm amped to go to church on Sunday. Man.
Lots of chew on there. But, hey, Nick, thanks so much for coming out, man.
Amen.
Yeah, that was a great, yeah, really excited to explore this dude's story a little bit more. And are his works, like, can you, like, purchase them? Or do you, yeah, how yeah, accessible are they?
I believe you can, yeah, so just further reading for folks, I believe you can get republished copies of both The Anxious Bench and The Mystical Presence on Amazon. There's some good works out there that's on kind of Mercerburg theology in general and kind of gets into his stuff. A guy named Bradford Littlejohn, scholar, I believe, edited a series on him that's worth looking into that I'd recommend. I also know an old friend from seminary, Christopher Smith, who's the associate pastor at Phoenix United Reformed Church. I don't know if he's listening. If you are, Chris, I hope you're not a Dodgers fan still. but I think he actually wrote a master's thesis after his MDiv on Nevin as well. That might be worth looking into. Lots of resources out there. But yeah. I would say a good place to start for anyone is Daryl Hart's biography, John Williamson Nevin, High Church Calvinist.
All right. Sweet. Great.
Thanks, Nick.
Well, yeah, thanks again, man. Thanks for coming out. And thank you for listening, and we'll catch you again next time. See you later.
God bless you.
Bye.